In late December 2024, Nissan announced the plan to merge with Honda. Well, they're calling it a merger, but it is more like a takeover. A shotgun marriage, hastily arranged by the Japanese government to save a spiraling company left behind by the times. Again. Nissan's story has been up and down, but this latest ride down looks to finally be the end. In this video, a look at Nissan's tumble back down the stairs. But first, a quick reminder about the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first, with selected references attached. It really helps a lot, and one of the best ways to support the channel. So I deeply appreciate all of you. Thank you, and on with the show. In 1999, Carlos Ghosn was Renault's number two executive and a rising star. He joined Renault from the tire company Michelin in 1996, at a time of great turmoil. That year, Renault turned a $926 million fiscal loss. But thanks to aggressive cost-cutting and a lineup of new cars, the state-owned company swung to a $1 billion profit in 1998. Now Ghosn, or Le Cost Killer as he was called, was asked to join Nissan as his new COO and turn it around. In May 1999, Renault agreed to invest 5 billion euros into the struggling Japanese car maker for 36.8% of Nissan's shares, with a future option for more later. Years of excessive global expansion, foreign assimilation, and lackadaisical management had left Nissan with uneconomical factories, just 53% utilization, a crappy lineup, just 4 lines out of 40-plus were profitable, and unproductive workers. The move was met with great skepticism. People thought Nissan was done, and when it sank, Renault would sink with it. One London analyst insisted, Nissan probably shouldn't even be in the auto business. But over the next 2 years, Ghosn and his team of 40 French executives ruthlessly cut costs and paid off debt. Many of these changes broke the norms of how Nissan previously did business, but can be justified on the basis of a financial crisis. First, the Renault team simplified the company's complicated portfolio of cross-stock holdings. Nissan was holding the stocks of 1,300 companies just because they were part of the same business family, or Keiretsu. Second, the team halved the company's sprawling web of suppliers. Many had been charging Nissan inflated prices, again just because they were family. Relationship managers were assigned to get the best price, family or not. Such efforts have real benefits and yielded at least $2.25 billion in savings. Third, the Renault team shook up the employee incentive structure. Ghosn broke norms by elevating various younger people over peers who would have otherwise received those positions on the basis of seniority. And finally, and perhaps most appallingly from a Japanese cultural perspective, his Nissan revival plan cuts 21,000 jobs through attrition and shuts down 5 factories. Such a thing, routine in the United States, was vexing to the Japanese. Yet it can be argued that cuts were needed to shake off the cruft. For instance, Nissan appointed many former senior managers to be advisors or coordinators, ghost jobs with no operational authority but often hindered progress. Those were gone. As a carrot to soothe wounded egos, Ghosn plays to Nissan's greatest hits by bringing back classic cars like the Z Series and the GTR. Moreover, nobody in Japan could deny the financial results. In 2002, Nissan returned to profitability ahead of schedule. Ghosn's success and unique background brought him fame beyond that of the business world. He was lauded by his peers, named Industry Leader of the Year by Automotive News for 3 straight years. The Japanese even famously made a manga about him. And other car makers wanted him to come save them too. In the 2000s, Ford and General Motors fell into crisis, and the government had to issue emergency loans to 2 of them. Steve Rattner, appointed by the U.S. government to be its point man, the so-called car czar, tried to recruit Ghosn to run General Motors. Imagine how Ghosn's star would have risen even further had that happened. But he turned it down. In 2002, Renault raised its stake in Nissan to 43%, and Nissan acquired a 15% stake in Renault, though without the equivalent voting capacity. 3 years later, in 2005, Ghosn became Renault's CEO without needing to step down from his current position at Nissan. Things at Nissan were looking good. They hit their 2002 three-year plan's goals by selling a million more cars per year by 2005 while maintaining strong operating margins of 10%. Such good performance was lifted by a good U.S. market, lots of Pathfinder SUVs and Altima passenger cars. At a press conference, Ghosn declared Nissan's recovery from crisis complete. Yet, he had apparently felt that there was more work to be done at the combined companies to grow them further. He immediately declared another three-year plan, the Value Up, to add yet another million cars in annual sales. Core to Ghosn's growth strategy was tapping the booming Chinese automotive market. In 2000, Nissan set up a joint venture between itself, a state-owned car maker called Dongfeng Motor, and two other car companies. The JV was called Fengsun Auto, which basically means Wind God. Fengsun was basically a local assembly operation, producing Chinese variants of Nissan's popular Bluebird car with technical help from a company in Taiwan called Yulong. Fengsun acquired a factory from its JV partner and produced 2 billion RMB of profits. This success prompted the Chinese government to desire a deeper partnership. So Ghosn traveled to mainland China in 2001, and in September of the following year, negotiated a 50-50 partnership producing passenger cars, trucks, and the like. The new JV got off to a rocky start. Fengsun was a fast-moving Chinese organization with important pricing decisions sometimes made in as soon as an hour. The goal was to mate that with Nissan's technology prowess. But the initial setup had things in reverse. Chinese workers were in charge of production, and the Japanese were in charge of sales. A 10% sales decrease in 2004 forced these problems to be rectified in a restructured constitution that aligned the teams to their proper order. In 2005, Dongfeng Nissan's sales exploded 160%, making it the fastest-growing carmaker in China that year. And they remained a top 10 car maker in China for the next few years after other major JVs like those backed by VW and GM. Throughout the 2000s, Nissan faced major short and long-term challenges. In the short term, there was the global financial crisis. Sales fell 22%, and the company turned a $2.9 billion net loss in 2009. They were forced to cut thousands of jobs. And then there was the devastating March 2011 earthquake, which damaged factories and halted the global supply chains. Nissan and the rest of the Japanese car industry worked around the clock to get back on track. In the background of all of this, there were major, long-term industry-wide developments that Ghosn correctly saw as upending the whole industry. I point to the famous 2015 presentation by former Fiat Chrysler CEO Sergio Marchionne, Confessions of a Capital Junkie, which lays it all out pretty well. In the presentation, Marchionne wrote about the effects of rising R&D costs to meet ever-tightening safety and environmental regulations. More miles per gallon of gasoline, new safety equipment, stronger car bodies, but light ones too because of the MPG. All of this means higher fixed costs of car development. Marchionne's estimate was $132 billion in 2014, which in turn means needing to sell a lot more cars for a good return. Moreover, the high proportion of fixed costs causes big swings in profitability as sales fluctuate. The interesting thing is that about half, less than half of those development costs are for things customers do not differentiate on, like those safety features. Car maker consolidation can help share those costs and save money for the things that customers actually do care about. The car makers that can get big enough are the ones that will survive. The well-connected Carlos Ghosn correctly foresaw all of this, and he also rightfully believed that the Renault-Nissan alliance, with its 6 million annual units sold, had the potential to compete with VW, Toyota, or GM. His production goal for the two seemed to have been about 10 million cars a year. So in 2011, he told reporters that Nissan's latest plan, its longest yet, would raise global market share from 5.8% to 8% while also raising operating margins. This would be achieved in part by selling more into Japan, China, and the United States, where Nissan hoped to grow their share to 10% by 2017. These were difficult targets, and the company sought to achieve them in several, arguably unhealthy ways. First, they started offering deep discounts on their cars and for a long time thereafter. By 2018, Nissan incentives averaged 16.7%, according to J.D. Power, higher than the industry's 10%. They also structured their dealer incentives to favor very aggressive sales. A particularly popular one was a stair-step incentive. If dealers hit ambitious sales quotas, they get nice cash bonuses. If they fall short, they get nothing. Internally, they called it grow or go. This all-or-nothing arrangement worked fine at the beginning, when sales quotas were relatively reachable. But as quotas repeatedly ratcheted up, bonuses got rarer, and dealers got desperate or disgruntled. Many left altogether. Another arguably unhealthy long-term sales strategy was selling more into rental fleets. Rental car customers rack up big miles on a car before selling it into the used car market. These fleets are large, so it can disrupt the car models' resale value for everyone else. These actions reek of growth at all costs. It trashed brand value, annoyed dealers, and worried consumers. Moreover, the company's lineup started to stagnate. The late 2000s and early 2010s saw American tastes shift towards SUVs and trucks, in part due to cheaper gas costs. And once again, Nissan's core sedan lines fell out of favor. In response, they introduced a few high-potential products that had the right idea in mind, but eventually fizzled out. There was the Nissan Titan pickup truck, introduced in 2003, as a direct challenge to Ford and GM's core profit centers. But Nissan found it tough to manufacture, the truck's look went stale, and sales fell short of Goan's public annual sales targets of 100,000. There was the Nissan Leaf. It was an EV pioneer, and Goan touted it for many years. And Goan was even super early to self-driving, saying in 2013 that Nissan cars would be able to drive themselves by 2020. EVs and self-driving are winning ideas, so it turns out, but Nissan's execution was lacking, leading to missed opportunities. For example, while Nissan was developing the Nissan Leaf, Renault was developing their own EV too, the Zoe. The two cars had almost nothing in common, even the battery, over which the two teams could not come to terms on. So the idea was apparently to let the two duke it out in the market. The issue was later rectified, but the resulting cars were too expensive for the general consumer, leading to lost time and momentum. As I mentioned, Goan and his management correctly saw that consolidation was needed. In 2005, the two companies worked together only in purchasing, but Goan strove for closer ties, particularly in manufacturing. In 2008, for instance, the two companies worked together hand in hand to build a plant in India. Now, in the wake of the 2011 announcement, he pushed his engineers to work even more closely. Goan cut individual budgets to force them to collaborate, and named managers with responsibilities in both companies. He also wanted 70% of the alliance's cars made from one of three platforms by 2020, compacts, minivans, and mid-sized vehicles. This was called the Renault-Nissan Common Module Family, which enabled cars like the successful Nissan Rogue compact SUV. But attempts like these ran into troubles, touching the simmering cultural and geopolitical tensions inside the alliance. Car engineers bristle at these sort of things, can't blame them for it, it sort of feels soulless. A former Japanese union leader was quoted in the New York Times saying, "The powertrain, then the transmission, then it was the next thing and then the next thing, until it got to a place where the car's identity was at stake. Some people started asking, isn't that going much too far?" And then there was what Nissan perceived as its uneven arrangement, where the smaller Renault had voting power over Nissan, but not vice versa, and that Nissan was increasingly propping up the other company. Nissan did not believe a partnership could be a true partnership until this can be fixed, but Renault saw the shareholding arrangement as a matter of contract. And since both companies were so tight with their governments, such tensions had geopolitical concerns. Famously, in 2015, the French government raised its stake in Renault, which threatened Nissan. This led to a kerfuffle and a face-saving agreement that the French government would not interfere in Nissan's operations. And then there were the problems with Ghosn himself. As so famously said, you die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Ghosn ran Nissan for a very long time, and after nearly 20 years, he had cemented himself into the company with a hand-picked board and no credible successors. Particularly after being made CEO of Renault in 2005, Ghosn grew a taste for the jet-setting life, buying art, investing in wineries, and hanging with the elite bigwigs at Davos. You need some good pay to fund such a lifestyle, and the issue with that was that Ghosn was already being paid a lot, at least in the context of Nissan being a Japanese company. In 2010, he was reported to have made $9.6 million in cash and stock. Just to compare, the next highest paid Nissan executive that year made $2.2 million, and Akio Toyoda, Toyota's chairman, made just $1.4 million, a salary about as good as a decent AI researcher, so it turns out. Though definitely true, he is part of the founding family. Even Howard Stringer, the Welsh-American CEO of Sony, made just $4.5 million that year. Which, to be clear, is life-changing money for anyone, including me. Unless, of course, you're the type to rent out Versailles for your wedding. Ghosn's pay disputes, his perhaps overstayed tenure, his lifestyle, and the tensions over a forced merger eventually led to his downfall. The proximate cause behind the whole fiasco was the discovery by internal auditors that residences in Lebanon and Brazil had been purchased by Nissan for Ghosn's personal use. Unusually, the internal team that discovered these went straight to law enforcement to discuss them. Nissan's board was not informed and didn't know about this until the news broke. In November 2018, Carlos Ghosn and a top deputy was lured to Japan on the pretense of a high-level meeting. Then he was arrested, stripped of his positions, and charged with underreporting his income by some 5 billion yen over 5 years. Several other charges were later added. Ghosn claimed innocence and was eventually released on bail. A year later, he flees Japan to Lebanon in a daring escape, where he was apparently hidden inside a musical equipment box. He settled in Lebanon, claiming that he was fleeing a rigged justice system. Unfortunately, the two Americans who helped smuggle him out of the country were arrested in the U.S., extradited to Japan, and jailed for 1 to 2 years. They claimed that Ghosn had misled them. The SEC alleged that Ghosn and his team at Nissan worked to raise his compensation by up to $140 million and conceal that fact. All three settled and paid nominal fines in 2019 to settle the allegations. Good times all around. As I mentioned, Ghosn was a critical connector within the company, and his abrupt departure threw things into a loop. Even more so when his immediate successor as Nissan CEO, Hiroto Saikawa, then had to resign when it came out that he himself had violated internal rules about his stock pay. From 2019 to 2021, Nissan struggled to regain itself after the excesses of the Ghosn era amidst a pandemic. They cut more jobs, closed a few more factories abroad, dialed down the incentives and fleet sales, and they reset their relations with their dealers. For that, they took a sizable loss of revenue, though that has since come back. Another major reset Nissan wanted was to reset its unequal shareholding relationship with Renault. Such a deal took a while, failed all over with toxicity, leaks to the press, massive internal infighting, and tangled ties to disentangle. The final deal was sealed in 2023 after Nissan forced out its COO and two of its directors, which stridently objected to the deal. This deal trimmed Renault's stake in Nissan to 15% by selling some shares and putting others into a trust. Nissan gained voting rights for the 15% that it held in Renault. And in exchange, Nissan will buy into Renault's new EV division, Ampere. This thing is complicated. And I haven't even mentioned Mitsubishi Motors up until now. That awkward third child bolted on in 2016 after a major emissions scandal. They've been hanging around ever since, part of the alliance, but their future cloudy. At the announcement, Nissan CEO Makoto Uchida said, "This alliance has gone through a lot, but the past is the past. We had to debate about the future. For me, China was a wake-up call, and we also face a massive challenge in terms of rolling out electric vehicles in the United States." Speaking of which, I don't think anyone could have anticipated that the Chinese EV natives would come up as fast and aggressively as they did. These Chinese EV companies develop, make, and sell cars like as if they're consumer electronics. Fueled by a powerful EV ecosystem and a titanic domestic market that allowed for true economies of scale, these Chinese EV companies can produce incredible products at hyper speed. I think the example of Xiaomi's entrance into the EV market perfectly illustrates this. What does a company more known for phones know about the joy of driving, purists might ask? Yet just 3 years after declaring their entrance in the market in 2021, Xiaomi has brought out some amazing cars. Xiaomi's car puts together scaled components pioneered by BYD, Huawei, and Kato to get the performance, and in so many colors. And then to achieve customer differentiation, they put their HyperOS operating system into the car. This lets them integrate the car into their ecosystem, which already includes things as varied as blenders, microphones, humidifiers, and projectors. Xiaomi claims that their SU7 SUV seamlessly connects with 1,000 different gadgets. It also somewhat justifies Xiaomi's selling the car at below cost. The Chinese EV industry spits fire like none other, and it is one of the most formidable class of tech products to ever emerge from anywhere. The old guard, Chinese internal combustion engine joint ventures like Dongfeng Nissan, got rolled as they struggled to keep up. In 2023, Nissan's Chinese sales fell some 30%. Similar declines are projected for 2024. The utilization at their 7 factories in China is said to be 50%. China makes up a third of Nissan's sales. It's basically their top market. And while this is not a Nissan-specific thing, Honda and Toyota are fighting hard there too, and certainly does not help that senior management at Nissan was tousling with itself and Renault on a share deal as it happened, fiddling while Rome burns. And now the management chaos will presumably go on for years as merger talks with Honda go forth. Before we conclude, I want to thank the user known as Vitek for inspiring this video, though it came out way later than I thought it would. The news have been pretty clear that the Honda-Nissan talks were initiated when word got out that the Taiwanese giant Foxconn was sniffing around Renault or those trust banks thinking about buying into Nissan. Foxconn has been chasing the EV industry for a while, looking to enable a client to break into the US and the rest of the world. They tried Lordstown and Fisker with little effect. Nissan would be the ultimate play. And I reckon Foxconn can make a good EV. They helped on the LuxGen N7 SUV, and I find it a fine automobile. The issue is that Foxconn hasn't had the best time running sharp, and Nissan is one of Japan Inc.'s crown jewels. Thus, the abrupt tie-up with Honda. The Honda is not super stoked about dealing with Nissan's problems, which include an aging lineup and a lopsided cost situation where Japan accounts for less than 20% of car production, but almost half of the workforce. Infamously, Honda's CEO was asked at the press conference why Nissan would make a good business partner for Honda, and he said, "That's a difficult one." Honda wants Nissan to triple its profit by 2026 to pass a test for the merger to continue, putting the onus on Nissan to try and save itself. But if they can do that, then why merge? Anyway, the whole thing is a raging dumpster fire. I think there's a decent chance the merger happens. After that, who knows? Whether it happens or doesn't happen, in either case, the end of Nissan as an independent entity approaches. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the newsletter, and I'll see you guys next time.